The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. Century of Lies is a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Let's start this week with the man who's likely to become our next Attorney General, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III. The Senate Judiciary Committee held its hearings on Sessions on January 10th and 11th. The senator's colleagues from that committee questioned him at length on a variety of topics, and Beauregard gave them carefully scripted replies. Last week, to get a clearer idea of Beauregard and his likely policies, we listened to a part of a June 2016 DEA oversight hearing before the Judiciary Committee. Beauregard made clear that he thought the best way to deal with opiate use and drugs in general is a law enforcement-centered approach, in spite of the fact that a law enforcement-centered approach has failed for decades. This week, we're going to listen to portions of another Judiciary Committee hearing to hear what Beauregard has to say about civil rights and the police. But first, let's look at a couple of recent news items relating to civil rights and the police to put what we're going to hear into perspective. Unless you've been living under a rock for the past few years, you will know that the Chicago Police Department has been under investigation because of several horrible incidents of racism and police brutality. These incidents are only coming to light and getting broad public exposure because we live in the information age where many people have cameras on their phones and even more people have social media accounts. Well, on January 13th of this year, the Justice Department announced the findings of its investigation into the Chicago Police Department. According to the department's news release, they found, quote, reasonable cause to believe that the Chicago Police Department engages in a pattern or practice of using force, including deadly force, in violation of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. The department found that CPD officers' practices unnecessarily endanger themselves and result in unnecessary and avoidable uses of force. The pattern or practice results from systemic deficiencies in training and accountability, including the failure to train officers in de-escalation and the failure to conduct meaningful investigations of uses of force, end quote. Among its findings, quote, the Justice Department investigation found that CPD officers have engaged in a pattern or practice of using force, including deadly force, that is unreasonable in violation of the Fourth Amendment. This pattern or practice includes shooting at fleeing suspects who presented no immediate threat, shooting at vehicles without justification, using less lethal force, including tasers, against people who pose no threat, using force to retaliate against and punish individuals, using excessive force against juveniles. In addition, the following practices contribute to the pattern or practice of excessive force: failing to effectively de-escalate situations or to use crisis intervention techniques to reduce the need for force, employing tactics that unnecessarily endanger officers and result in avoidable shootings and other uses of force, and failing to accurately document and meaningfully review officers' use of force. With regard to accountability, the investigation found, the city fails to investigate the majority of cases it's required to investigate by law. When it does investigate, the questioning of officers is aimed at eliciting information favorable to the officer, and investigators do not confront officers with inconsistent physical evidence. The city does not take sufficient steps to secure accurate and complete witness statements, including by preventing officers from concealing misconduct. Discipline is haphazard, unpredictable, and does not deter misconduct. The Justice Department identified a number of other systemic deficiencies, including inadequate training and supervision, insufficient support for officer wellness and safety, data collection systems that impede transparency, a promotions system seen as political and unfair by officers, and failure to adequately address racially discriminatory conduct by officers, which in some respects is caused by deficiencies in CPD's systems of training, supervision, and accountability, and the corrosive effect on police legitimacy of excessive force, which falls most heavily on Chicago's communities of color, end quote. Now, the day before that announcement, on January 12th, the Justice Department announced, quote, that it has entered into a court-enforceable agreement with the City of Baltimore to resolve the department's findings that the Baltimore City Police Department engages in a pattern and practice of conduct that violates the First, Fourth, and Fourteenth Amendments of the Constitution, as well as federal anti-discrimination laws, end quote. Now that we have more context, let's turn back to Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, who's likely to become our next Attorney General. In November of 2015, the Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on Oversight, Agency Action, Federal Rights, and Federal Courts held a hearing titled, "The War on Police: How the Federal Government Undermines State and Local Law Enforcement." That hearing was chaired by Senator Ted Cruz. The witnesses you're about to hear are Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General Vinita Gupta, who's head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, and Ronald L. Davis, the Director of the Justice Department's Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services. They're being questioned, well, harangued, really, by Beauregard. Before any more ado can be furthered, let's hear that audio.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this is a hearing I think is important. We need to talk about some of these issues. And there is a perception, not altogether unjustified, that this department, the Civil Rights Division, goes beyond fair and balanced treatment, but has an agenda. That's been a troubling issue for a number of years, frankly. Your predecessor nominee was rejected for this job, the Civil Rights Division job. It was, according to the Fraternal Order of Police, they wrote a letter that noted that under his leadership, the Legal Defense Fund for the NAACP volunteered their services to represent Wesley Cook, better known as Mumia Abu-Jamal, our country's most notorious cop killer. This nomination can be interpreted only one way. It is a thumb in the eye of our nation's law enforcement officers. It demonstrates a lack of regard or empathy for those who strive to serve you and everyone in our nation and keep them safe in their streets and homes. We believe that law enforcement and minority communities need to build even greater bonds of trust and respect, yet your Civil Rights Division, under the leadership of the prior Officer Thomas Perez and Roy Austin, has increasingly built obstacles to this goal with its punitive approach toward local law enforcement agencies. So now your nomination, you've been named as acting, is that right, but have not yet been nominated?
That is correct.
And you, prior to joining the Department of Justice, you served as Deputy Legal Director for the American Civil Liberties Union, and director for its Center for Justice. And prior to that, you were an attorney for the Racial Justice Program. And prior to that, you served as a lawyer for the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. So I'm just saying that you come from a background that indicates an aggressiveness in these cases. The Civil Rights Division can fulfill a important role. I've seen attorneys, I've worked with them in a grand jury, investigating police, and the goal is and must be to obtain truth and find out what the real facts are. So let's talk about this a bit here. First, Mr. Davis, I talked to an experienced law enforcement officer in Alabama who's he said the kind of problems that we're seeing and the legal actions that have been taken and the marches and protests about police do have the tendency to cause people, as he said, to stay under the shade tree and not walk the streets like community-based policing that you advocate promotes. We won't go into the details about it, but I truly believe community-based policing is a great thing. And police are going to be in dangerous situations, I know you'll agree, and sometimes they'll confront people who are violent, and they have to be able to defend themselves, do they not?
Yes, sir, they do.
And sometimes that can lead to misunderstandings and false claims by the criminal against a police officer sometimes.
That is correct, Senator, and I would tell you, and I'm sure the esteemed colleague in your state will share this with you. When it comes to the evaluation of those decisions, the officers are more concerned about the decisions within their local department and local elected leaders and how they're going to be treated for those decisions. So that's always a concern because they also just want fairness and want people to understand the nuance and the difficulties of being police.
I keep thinking that Gilbert and Sullivan, I think it's Pirates of Penzance, constabulary duties are to be done. The policeman's lot is not a happy one. So it's not easy to go out and arrest people and have to make these decisions and put them in the slammer sometimes. In your speech that you made to the United States attorneys in New Jersey, Ms. Gupta, you say there that you talk about the charges made against police and what police say in their own defense and conclude there is truth in both these perspectives, presumably what both sides say about it, the criminal or the arrestee or not. And you also close by saying if we would take time to listen, really listen, why protesters take the streets, why police officers risk their lives every day, we would find that while perspectives may differ, people's aspirations and their values tend to be very similar. We all want safe streets. We all want stronger communities. We all believe in justice. This was an article written by Roger Clegg and Hans von Spakovsky, both former members of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, your division. And they say, we find it hard to imagine that, for example, Black Lives Matter protesters in St. Louis chanting, "Pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon," right after two New York police officers were assassinated, have the same aspirations and values as law enforcement officers who risk their lives every day. Do you see the concern that police officers might have about those kind of comments?
I find those kinds of comments abhorrent, and I think that they do a disservice to the legions of peaceful protesters that are raising attention to serious issues around the country.
Well, I was really referring to your comments. In 2013, while working for the ACLU, you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in which you stated you were elated when you learned that Attorney General Holder had, quote, directed all federal prosecutors to exercise their discretion toward ending the relentless warehousing of inmates, the vast majority of whom are minorities in federal prison for low-level drug crimes. Do you think most of the prisoners are for low-level drug crimes?
Senator, at the helm at my
how
job...
How would you define a low-level drug crime? There are only 15 in the federal penitentiary, I understand, for simple possession of drugs.
Senator, as the head of the Civil Rights Division, I enforce the civil rights statutes that we are given and do not have a say-so in our sentencing policies at the division.
Well, I'm troubled by your comments. That's all I'm saying. You want to be the head of the Civil Rights Division? I don't feel good about that comment. How about this? In the Fordham Law Review in 2005, you wrote, "We do not have criminal justice system whose subjugation of people of color is contingent upon..." Excuse me. "We do have a criminal justice system whose subjugation of people of color is contingent upon individualizing all cases. It is how we have managed to rationalize racism in the criminal justice system." Now, as I understand this theory, and it's been about for some time, it says you should not evaluate individual cases based on whether or not a person is guilty of that crime or not, but some other theory involving racism. Do you think a case should be evaluated simply on the facts, whether a person is guilty of the crime or not?
Senator, at the Civil Rights Division, I oversee career prosecutors and lawyers who are committed to investigating the facts and the evidence and going where the law takes them based on that. And that is what we are committed to at the Civil Rights Division.
Well, I'm very troubled by that radical statement you made in that article. You go on to say in that article, "Critical race lawyering is about transforming business as usual in the criminal justice system. A business that is usually masked as being racially neutral, bias-free, and just the crime facts, ma'am, industry We have to transform that business, as usual, into a counter-narrative about police practices, racial bias, and the irrationality of many of our criminal justice policies. Do you still adhere to those views?
Senator, that was an article that I read, I think, over a decade ago. But at the Civil Rights Division, I, as I said, enforce the statutes that Congress has given us to enforce. And that is what I do. And that is what the career lawyers and prosecutors do at the Civil Rights Division each and every day.
Well, it's clear that police officers all over America are concerned about the Department of Justice. And I think based on those writings that the acting head you now have about law enforcement and police gives them a basis to be concerned.
That was Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General Vinita Gupta, head of DOJ's Civil Rights Division, and Ronald L. Davis, Director of the DOJ's Community-Oriented Policing Services. Beauregard is the nominee for Attorney General in the Trump administration. The Judiciary Committee held its confirmation hearings on January 10th and 11th. I thought of playing in some of the audio from that, and we still might in the next week or so. Thing is, that was a carefully scripted performance. Beauregard was playing not just to the committee, he was also playing to the American public, trying to allay their fears and to convince us that he's not as extreme as he actually is. Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III is the wrong person for the job of Attorney General. His nomination should be opposed. Many organizations are working to stop the nomination, including the NAACP, the Drug Policy Alliance, and DCMJ.org. More information at drugpolicy.org. You're listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Now, for the last half of today's show, we're going to have a segment on this new report by the National Academy of Sciences on the health effects of cannabis and cannabinoids, which was issued January 12th. This report was a follow-up, really, to the 1999 report on cannabis and health, which was itself a follow-up to the 1983 report on marijuana and health. They've all found that health concerns regarding marijuana are quite minimal. Compared to alcohol, certainly, marijuana is relatively benign. That sort of comparison, unfortunately, was beyond the remit of the Academy. As far as public policy is concerned, they had this to say, quote, "The political landscape for the commercialization, decriminalization, and use of cannabis is constantly evolving. As federal and state agencies continue to grapple with these important public policy issues, it is important to consider that each political decision may have significant public health implications. As laws and policies continue to change, research must also. Unfortunately, research on the health effects and therapeutic potential of cannabis use has been limited in this country, despite enormous changes at the state level. As such, there is currently limited research evidence to guide policy. This lack of aggregated knowledge is a significant impediment to not only scientific understanding of cannabis, but also the advancement of public policy and the nation's overall public health." End quote. The Health Effects of Cannabis and Cannabinoids was released on January 12th. They held an online news conference to announce the release and summarize the results. Here's some of that audio. The first voice you hear will be that of Sean Hennessy, Ph.D., a professor of epidemiology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine.
So the committee found three indications for which there was either substantial or conclusive evidence for the efficacy of either cannabis itself, cannabis-based products, or synthetic cannabinoids. The first of those is nausea and vomiting associated with cancer chemotherapy. That is an FDA-approved indication for two synthetic cannabinoids. Further, in adults with chronic pain and in persons with muscle spasms associated with multiple sclerosis, there is good quality evidence that some patients obtain substantial relief based from either cannabis or cannabis-based products. For the other conditions that we examined, there was either limited, no, or insufficient evidence either for or against a therapeutic effect. I'd now like to move to potential adverse effects of cannabis, starting with respiratory disease. So the committee found that there was substantial evidence that long-term smoking of cannabis results in worse respiratory symptoms, including an increase in the frequency of episodes of chronic bronchitis. There are a couple of physiologic measures of lung function that are affected by long-term cannabis smoking, although the clinical importance of those physiologic metrics is unknown. There's also moderate evidence that stopping smoking of cannabis results in improvements in some of the respiratory problems, including chronic bronchitis, that I mentioned above. There was really limited evidence of associations between cannabis smoking and onset of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and of onset of asthma and asthma exacerbations. Now for the discussion on injury, I'll turn the presentation over to Bob Wallace.
Let me start with issues related to injury and overall mortality. We did find that cannabis use prior to driving increases the risk of being involved in a motor vehicle accident. With regard to children in states where cannabis use is legal, there has been an increased risk of unintentional cannabis overdose injuries, and the evidence for that was moderate. With regard to all-cause mortality, that is, general causes of death, we found insufficient evidence, unclear and insufficient evidence, that recreational cannabis smoking was associated with all-cause mortality or, in fact, with occupational injury. Let me turn next to the cancer issue. There was moderate evidence of no statistical association between cannabis smoking and the incidence of lung cancer, and that was also true of another smoking-related, tobacco smoking-related set of tumors, and that is head and neck cancers. There was limited evidence of a positive association between current, frequent, and chronic cannabis smoking and one particular type of testicular cancer. On the next slide, we list a number of cancer site, other cancer sites where there generally have been few or single studies, and in all these instances, there was insufficient evidence to support or refute an association, and that included esophageal cancer. And in the second bullet, you can see a number of cancers, including prostate, cervical, brain tumors, Hodgkin's lymphoma, penile cancer, anal cancer, and other tumors. And then finally, there have been mostly single studies that have looked at whether maternal use of cannabis during during pregnancy leads to cancer in the offspring. And again, there are single studies that have suggested an association for the variety of tumors that you can read in the third bullet. And we found insufficient evidence for all of these associations. So I wanted to finally talk about cardiometabolic risk, and we found limited and unclear evidence about the association between cannabis use and heart attack, stroke, and diabetes. So now I'd like to turn it over back to Professor McCormick to talk about some of the other issues.
When we looked at the literature on the effects of cannabis or cannabinoids on immunity, we found that there was a paucity of data on the effects of cannabis or other substances on the human immune system. In essence, there's insufficient data to draw overarching conclusions concerning the effects of cannabis smoke or cannabinoids on immune competence. There is some evidence to suggest that there may be limited anti-inflammatory activity, and there's insufficient evidence to support or refute a connection between cannabis or cannabinoid use and the effects on the immune status in individuals with HIV. Turning to prenatal, perinatal, and neonatal outcomes, we found strong evidence that smoking cannabis during pregnancy is linked to lower birth weights in infants. However, The relationship between smoking cannabis during pregnancy and other pregnancy and childhood outcomes is unclear. And I'd now like to turn over to Sachin Patel to talk about the psychosocial.
So with regard to cannabis use and psychosocial outcomes, the main findings were that recent cannabis use was found to impair performance in cognitive domains of learning, memory, and attention, with recent use being defined as use within the past 24 hours of evaluation. In addition, a limited number of studies suggest that there are impairments in cognitive domains of learning and memory and attention in individuals who have stopped smoking cannabis. And lastly, that cannabis use during adolescence is related to impairment in subsequent academic achievement, education, employment and income, and social relationships and social roles. Turning now to mental health outcomes. We found that there was substantial evidence for a statistical association between cannabis use and the development of schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders, with highest risk being associated with the most frequent cannabis use. In individuals with schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders, a history of cannabis use may be linked to better performance on measures of learning and memory tasks. In addition, cannabis use does not appear to increase the likelihood of developing depression, anxiety disorders, or post-traumatic stress disorder. For individuals diagnosed with bipolar disorder, nearly daily use may be linked to greater symptoms of bipolar disorder relative to non-cannabis users. In addition, heavy cannabis users are more likely to report thoughts of suicide than non-cannabis users. Lastly, regular cannabis is likely to increase the risk of developing a specific type of anxiety disorder than a social anxiety disorder. Those highlight the mental health outcomes with the strongest evidence.
You just heard Professor Sean Hennessy from the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, Robert B. Wallace, M.D., the Irene Ensminger Stecker Professor of Epidemiology and Internal Medicine in the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Iowa College of Public Health, Committee Chair Marie McCormick, M.D., who is a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health at Harvard University, and Sachin Patel, M.D., Ph.D. He's an associate professor and director in the Division of Addiction Psychiatry at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center. They were speaking at a news conference announcing the release of The Health Effects of Cannabis and Cannabinoids. This was a review of what the evidence clearly shows. There are certainly a lot of things which we have a good reason to believe cannabis can be useful, but there's just not enough of what they would consider decent research to be able to prove it. And the fact that marijuana is still in Schedule 1 is one of the reasons why we don't have the ability to get that research done. By descheduling marijuana entirely, we eliminate the problem and can actually engage in the research that's needed. The thing is, whether you agree that this report is the current state of knowledge in marijuana science, you have to know that this is the report that lawmakers and policymakers around the U.S. and around the world are going to be looking at and referring to as we move forward with medical cannabis and with adult social use marijuana. A full-text copy of the report is available on the web from the National Academy website. That's nationalacademies.org. Everyone should download a copy and become familiar with it. And, well, folks, that's it for this week. I thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. We'll be back next week with 30 minutes of news and information about the drug war and this century of lies. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.